Hello, my name is Sam Clements, and welcome to the special mini episode of the Picture House podcast. Today, I'm joined by co-writer and producer of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, Colin Trevorrow. Colin was on the podcast last year, actually, to talk about his film, The Book of Henry, and he told me that at that point, I was the last interview he was doing for Book of Henry, and he told me before we started to talk about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom that I was the first interview he's done for this film, so it's kind of a nice bookend there. What a fun coincidence. But yeah, it was lovely to be reunited with Colin. He's a very nice chap. I sort of thought it was interesting in this one because Colin co-wrote and directed the first film, but in this one, he's got a producer role and also a co-writer role, so I was interested to see why J.A. Bayona was appointed director, where that came from, and also what it's like, you know, following up the one of the biggest films of all time with Jurassic World, what the challenges are as a writer to go back into that universe and think of a way to tell a story which will compete with that first film and also expand on it. What I liked about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, what they've actually done is they've made it more of a character piece following the two protagonists, and they've moved them into a much smaller, in some ways, environment to sort of let their character beats kind of shine through, along with all of the spectacular visual effects you'd expect from a Jurassic World / park film. It's a more intimate film, and I think it was kind of refreshing as a fan of the series to see it go in this direction, and it looks fantastic on a big screen, and there's a wonderful Michael Giacchino score. I mean, he always does wonderful scores, right? There's a brand new Giacchino score for this film, and I think he's a really great sound for this franchise, following in John Williams' footsteps from the first two Jurassic Park films. Anyway, that's a whole bunch of waffle. So without further ado, here's myself, Colin Trevorrow, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, in cinemas now. Enjoy! Thank you so much for talking to us today, Colin. A pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here, thank you.
It's also great to have another Jurassic World film in our cinemas. We're due to open the film when it opens on June 6th.
Yeah, that's right.
Audiences loved Jurassic World.
Thank you so much.
There must be, and I think there's a lot of anticipation for Fallen Kingdom.
I mean, I have a lot of anticipation. I'm really proud of this movie, man. I feel like this was a rare opportunity for a director to collaborate with another director in a way that I haven't seen in quite some time, and it was such a satisfying and enriching experience. At least for me. You'll have to talk to Bayona, but I loved it.
Okay, I'll get his side of the story. So because you co-wrote the first Jurassic World and directed, and with this one, you're back on writing duties, but not directing duties. I was wondering, at what point was that decision made?
I made that decision before Jurassic World even came out. I felt that, you know, I'm very conscious of what makes what audiences are responding to in franchises and what's keeping them interested. What I love about how people I respect have been evolving their franchises and changing them, and I felt that the best way to keep people engaged in this would be to have a different director and a different voice visually, but also to have a consistency in the storytelling and to make sure that there was a plan moving forward and the adventure that these characters were going on felt completely, linked and intrinsic to what people had seen in the first film.
At Picture Cinemas, we're a big fan of Bayona's work. I wondered, how involved were you in approaching Bayona and getting him on board for this one?
A lot. I mean, yes, we wrote the movie, but I also, I was a producer on the movie, and I was present throughout, but in a way that because I'm a director myself, I knew when not to be present and when to step away and to give my guy some space. And I chose Bayona as really, for me, like, it was the only choice because I knew the kind of film I wanted it to be. And we really wrote a movie for him. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Steven and Frank about it, Frank said, oh, no, we had actually, we'd talked to him before and we had considered him for the first movie as well. And we're giant fans. So it was the easiest decision in the world. And it happened very, very quickly. He was doing World War Z too at first. So we thought we weren't going to be able to get him. And then things changed and we were able to take advantage. We swooped in.
Oh, nice. Well, that's a great, it's a coup for the film, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
At what point, when you were working on the first one and you're in the middle of everything, do you start having ideas for a sequel where this story might go? And are there bits that actually you just need to park, I'll come back to that maybe later and maybe that will come into another film?
Yeah, I think, a lot of film writers will tell you that one of the biggest problems is too many ideas. I had a great producer that I work with once told me that one great idea is better than five great ideas. And I've always held that very close. And while we were working on the first film, even in the very early conception of it, I had conversations with Steven about how I saw this story playing out, because I do feel it's important to if you're going to to have the gift of making a trilogy, if some studio will pay for that, then, you know, you owe it to them to have a plan. And we did. And when the second one became a reality, Derek Connolly, my co-writer, and I drove across America. I had to take my car back to Vermont, where I lived, because I'd had it in LA while we were editing the film. So we just drove across the country and talked about our ideas. And we ended up having so many that we really had to show a certain amount of restraint. I think a lot of writing is restraint, is how far forward are we going to take this? There's so many big ideas. How much can we show? And we managed to really hone it into something that I felt served a second movie very well, which is much more character focused. It's richer. It's more emotional. It deals with some of the issues of science and overreach that Crichton's novels have. And it brings it from a very sort of, you know, big action adventure oriented kind of a movie and shifts it into something that's much more suspenseful and claustrophobic. And now that you've seen the movie, it's almost a horror film.
Absolutely. That's what really struck me, actually, how different it was in tone to the first one. And also kind of a delight that it wasn't a rehash of the first movie either. I think we've seen, you know, often sequels might be, it's the first one, but bigger. Yeah. And if anything, this is the first one, but smaller, and you've really heightened the drama and the tension.
Yeah, and those are the sequels that I love have done that. I feel like there's almost, first of all, I mean, Jurassic World is, you know, in a lot of ways, it's sort of, it's a 12-year-old's fantasy of what a Jurassic movie could possibly be. And so I felt, instead of trying to double down on that, let's recognize that our audience is aging with us and getting more mature. If you were 9 when you saw Jurassic World, you're 12 now, and maybe you're ready for something that's a little more complex and yet doesn't, you know, crack the foundation that it's all built on, doesn't give up on the thrills and the adventure and the romance and all the stuff that people come to these movies for.
It's quite refreshing to sort of see the location change and the various issues that come up with that.
Right.
I was, especially sort of in the final act, I was just amazed at sort of how that all played out, because it really does become a horror movie, I feel, at that point. Right. But a horror movie, you're right, for all the family.
And also, you know, a family drama in ways. And that was something that to me was the most important aspect. Is, you know, we don't want to spoil anything, but when you see what happens on a character level in the last act of that movie and how things change for all those characters and what their relationships are to each other moving into the future, the great franchises that we have rely on people's interest and in the people who are in them and the characters and what's going to happen to them next. And it feels like the Jurassic movies have been a little bit plagued in the past by relying only on, well, which dinosaurs are going to be in it and who are they going to eat. And I knew that there's no way that we would be able to go too much further forward or even have a successful trilogy if that's all we were relying on. And we had to turn this into a character-based franchise. And I hope by the time you get to the ending of this film, you have a lot of very wish fulfillment based questions. If you're a kid, of like, oh, well, you know, what is the world going to be like now? But also, what's going to happen to these people that we love?
I think the protagonist in Jurassic World made such an impact. Everyone was quite looking forward to seeing Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard re-team. Was it always hard to decide how they would be first introduced on screen? Like deciding what they've been doing for these last few years, what that first moment you see them is? Because I think especially Chris Pratt's got such a brilliant introduction in this film, which is, you know, proper like whooping and cheering for him.
I think for both of them, you know, we wanted to show that how much Claire's circumstances have changed and how much she has changed, and yet she's still using that skill set that she has. So we put her in an elevator and did a very similar shot, but now the elevator is janky and doesn't work, and you know, she's an activist, and all those things were written into the script very clearly. And I had a lot of conversations with Jay about story in every single moment, partially because we're both directors and we're able to have that kind of a dialogue. But I think that a director has to be not just intimately familiar with the story that we're telling, but where that story's going and what we're doing. And I didn't want him working in a vacuum and shooting in the dark. And so he knew what the third movie was going to be. He knew why we were making these choices, and it enabled him to, Chris's introduction is linked to what we're doing in the future, all of it. And that was something that was, it was very, as I said, it's a unique dynamic to have been able to be there, to show up every day with my backpack and my laptop and just be be like, what do you need, man? What do you need? And I really embraced it. I really loved it.
I really liked the sort of direction Claire's going in this film, and I can't wait to see what happens to her in the future. But I was sort of thinking, in terms of sequels, it's a bit like the difference between Sarah Connor in Terminator 1 and Sarah Connor in Terminator 2.
Almost in the first draft, we went that far. and then we felt a certain amount of restraint, and we're like, look, we want to make sure that, you know, her evolution, once you see, if you watch these three movies someday back to back, feels smooth and natural and organic. And so we made it very gradual. Like, she's still her, by the time you get to the end of this movie.
That was like a, oh, yes. Yeah. It was at the moment just before that sort of happened. I was like, oh, I wonder what Claire's doing right now. And then, yeah. Okay, there she is. She's going to kick ass. I also quite liked how you start to dovetail a little bit in with the original Jurassic Park and the sequel, with Ian Malcolm being a sort of a returning cameo type character. Was that something that you always wanted to do, to sort of bring in cast from the original film?
Yeah, you know, my theory on all of it, I feel like this whole... Well, these films really are kind of my, as a writer, you know, my dissertation on everything I've learned, you know, from studying other filmmakers and how stories have been told in this kind of, you know, long form, and how I would like to do it. And I think it can be done most effectively. And one of them is to bring, you know, to not rely too much on the older characters, but also to be able to bring them in slowly to be able to establish these new characters like Chris and Bryce and make them iconic in their own right. Mm-hmm. So that then when we bring them together with the older characters, it feels that much more momentous when it happens. You know, I think that bringing Jeff Goldblum into this film, Ian Malcolm is a very different presence in this film than he was in the first. And he's also a very different presence in The Lost World than he is in Jurassic Park. And so we have to take all of that into account and think about, well, where would he be now after those experiences? And I found him to be, he'd be Al Gore. You know, he'd be a guy with a beard who was like, look, I told you what was going to happen. And sure enough, it did. And now you have to deal with the consequences.
He's got some really killer dialogue in those scenes he's in.
Thank you.
In front of the Senate.
Well, I won't take credit for all of that. I, you know, some of that is from Crichton's original book.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And there was some dialogue that we were able to pull out of there that remained relevant even now. And that was a challenge for us, because you're weaving new dialogue that you're writing into Michael Crichton's dialogue and making it sound like it's written by the same person, and then you have Jeff Goldblum, who came in and put a little Goldblum on it, which never hurts.
I can imagine. I ended up after the film on the way home just watching videos of Jeff Goldblum online, because he's quite a presence, and
he's the best.
Watching him do his Jurassic Park song, he sort of wheels out when he does public appearances.
We did this thing together in January. We did this commercial that ran on the Super Bowl in America with him in a Jeep running from a T-Rex, driving away from T-Rex, and just getting to work with him for one day in that context where we were almost just both living out our fantasy of like what Ian Malcolm could be doing. It was just a blast.
It seems quite refreshing. He seems very proud of like Jurassic Park, and it's really refreshing to see like he wants to sort of be involved and talk about it and embraces that fandom. I imagine it could easily go sort of the other direction, and he might just want to put that behind him.
No, it's, I mean, there's a lot of love for Jurassic Park, and it's earned and it's deserved. And, you know, it's something that not just the actors who were in it, you know, and I've seen Laura many times recently, and I've communicated with Sam a little bit over the years, and they all are very proud to have been a part of something that obviously is indelible and has lived on in the imaginations of people who are in their 40s now, who have kids, who are bringing them to this. And, you know, the one, you know, for Jurassic World is something that I know people who have kids now react to a little bit differently, because, you know, if you have a 9-year-old, this is their story. And this myth is for them. And yet our challenge is to make something that adults can take their kids to and be equally fascinated with, or maybe not equally, but like, you know, 90%.
It was also, the other sort of link back is we see a picture of Richard Hammond.
Yes, John Hammond.
John Hammond, Richard Attenborough, John Hammond. That was a Freudian slip.
I know in England that's probably
Yeah, was that, again, sort of trying to sort of dovetail in with that original movie?
Yeah, it's important. You know,
challenge as a writer?
It is, but it's also, it's fun, and it's something that I think is necessary to make the first three films part of a larger story that was being told. And I think there are pieces of each of those films that are crucial to the story that we're telling. Jurassic Park 3 first addressed the ability for raptors to communicate with each other and how intelligent they are. And that's such a big part of Owen's story. And The Lost World, you know, focused on, you know, on corporate greed and, you know, a lot of the themes that we're getting into now. So I think that when we get to the end of the third film, we're doing a lot of work to tie this into a greater mythology, and that really is going to be the end of six films that have been a story that's been told over a long period of time. And you know, I'm really happy with the way that the character of Benjamin Lockwood and his relationship with John Hammond is woven into this movie. I think it makes it feel like it honestly has a reason to exist, has a purpose.
And brilliantly played by James Cromwell, who's sort of has that same gravitas on screen.
He does. And he's also such a powerful animal activist. And so somebody who, you know, that's coming from his heart, it's coming from a real place. And we were able to connect on that because I think he recognizes how, without being preachy, without being a message film, how valuable it is, especially for a series that, you know, exists in a world of science and of fact and of social issues and issues with, you know, genetic manipulation can talk about the way we treat animals in the world today.
Absolutely. And just to wrap up, you remiss not to mention Michael Giacchino's incredible music. Again, it's so great to have him back for this film. And I think the new stuff he's created is really wonderful.
It's so good. We got to record it here at Abbey Road and we had an amazing time. And we actually had a funny moment where Paul McCartney came to Abbey Road to visit while we were, Paul was there and, He was in the room with many people and he'd been told the story by Michael Giacchino. And I won't say it here, but he said out loud, like, well, it's so cool, this twist where this happens. And I had to be like, oh, no, well, Paul, we try not to say the things out loud that are. But it was a gift. It was great.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait to hear what he does for the third one.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Cheers, Colin.
Listening to the Picture House podcast, a Picture House's production brought to you by Picture House Cinemas. We would like to thank everyone who works at Picture House Cinemas and everyone who has ever attended a screening of a film at a Picture House cinema. Thanks for listening and see you next week.